Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to New Books in Sociology, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Rituparna, and today I'm going to be in conversation with Sriparna Chattopadhyay. Well, Sriparna is a social scientist with an MA and a PhD from Brown University, US, in the interdisciplinary program in demography and anthropology, and a BA honors in economics from St. Xavier's College, Mumbai. Is currently an associate professor in the School of Social Sciences at Flame University, Pune. Her past and current research concerns three interlinked themes: gendered violence, such as domestic and sexual violence, unmasking intersectional inequities, including those emanating from health systems, and analysis of reproduction using a reproductive justice lens. She has worked in academia, government, and nonprofits in the US, UK, and India. Her research has been published in prestigious international and national journals and has been covered by the global press. Today, we are going to discuss her book, The Gravity of Hope, which has been published by Crossed Arrows in 2023. Sriparna, thank you so much for giving time to NBN and talking to me about your very, very heartfelt book. Welcome.
Thank you, Rituparna, for inviting me to the podcast.
Right. So could we begin by you talking about the context in which this book is written?
Sure. So I've been researching domestic violence since 2003, which is when I finished my master's. And over the years, you know, we've had some progress in terms of delegitimizing the normalcy of domestic violence in India. But it still persists. It is ubiquitous and was brought into sharp relief by the COVID-19 pandemic, when we all know that violence against women and children skyrocketed all around the world. So in a sense, it was partly the pandemic and partly the obligation I felt towards the women that I spoke to that made me write this book. And I believe that these stories needed to be narrated. The other thing about the book is that it's not only based on my ethnographic research, which consisted of a year of fieldwork in Bombay, but it also has insights which are derived from nearly two decades of working in this area. So, and before I published the book, I had a significant body of work on domestic violence, but writing a book felt daunting. At the same time, it also felt necessary. And for that, I have my PhD advisors to thank me, because they kept nagging me to do this. But of course, in a good way. But the thing is, I did not want to write a book that was filled with academic prose, because I wanted the book to be used for anti-violence work. So I decided to write a book that was accessible in terms of pricing, in terms of language, to a much larger number of people: students, activists, policymakers, women's rights organizations, and the general public.
Right. And I would also want to know how you as the author is actually a part of the book. Do you think your story is also an integral part of it?
So I would think that my story is not an integral part of the book, because it's not autoethnographic or a memoir, although in parts I have used some examples and, you know, I have used poems to describe what I have felt. So I have not erased myself out of the book, which has influenced the tone and texture of the book and also the title of the book. Readers, if they read the prologue, they will know why I have titled it The Gravity of Hope. And, you know, in conventional academic writing, I feel that the author is typically absent, because the form demands that that be the case, right? It's typically in the third person. And while I feel that this book is deeply anthropological and ethnographic, it is not a conventional academic book. And I think readers will identify that. But I also think equally that as researchers, we have to be open with some of our own vulnerabilities in order to make the process of research and writing a little less asymmetric, because there's always this power imbalance between the person who's doing the research and the respondents who are being researched, in a sense. So I think that, you know, it also prevents the othering of our research participants. There's a possibility of a different kind of solidarity, at least one hopes so, that might emerge when one takes this approach. And I think some feminist ethnographers already do this, but I have tried to do this in the book very self-consciously.
Right. Now, I also want to ask you about the process of data collection, because it's such a sensitive topic. How was the process of doing fieldwork?
So there's a pretty long answer to this question. And the reason is because I use so many methods to collect data. So first of all, I would say that, yes, it is a sensitive topic. I found the experience of fieldwork quite overwhelming at times. And as I said, I was, you know, only 23 years old when I started this work. And I had done independent research earlier on sensitive topics, but I don't think I was fully prepared for what I heard and bore witness to. And as I say in this book, and also in a different essay that I wrote for an edited volume, which you might remember, Rituparna, you and your colleague Dipali facilitated an interesting discussion on, I used multiple methods to collect data, ethnographic, archival research, and quantitative analysis. But the emotional labor that is involved in these three methods vary significantly. And one might think that, you know, doing ethnographic research was the hardest, but it wasn't. For me, it was doing archival research in the City Civil and Sessions Court in Bombay, which, you know, in my mind, and I know from my field notes as well, it stands out as the darkest period of my field work. And the reason for this is that, you know, in many instances, women had been killed by their husbands or in-laws. The documents had artifacts like dying declarations, autopsy, medical reports that bore testament to this violence that women had suffered. And in most of these cases, given that conviction rates for domestic violence are so low, women had not got justice. The victims, you know, they were truly victims in that sense. There was no one to speak for them, and they were unable to do it themselves. So while I was speaking to women in Sundarnagar, you know, there were moments of laughter, lighthearted banter. And, you know, while there were tears too, I felt that I was able to comfort them at least momentarily. But in the archives of the court, it just seemed so hopeless, like, you know, as if I was staring into an abyss. And the second part of the question, which has to do with the process of data collection, I used a snowball sample. And since the topic was very sensitive, I started off with general questions about women's health. That seemed safer. And families were used to it because, you know, numerous surveys by government and NGOs in the region had asked them quite a few questions around this topic. So there were different rounds of surveys, like we know the NFHS and so on. And when I began my fieldwork, you know, HIV/AIDS was a serious problem at the time. And there were awareness campaigns for residents. So they had become accustomed to speaking at least about health. So gradually I built rapport and I built some connections with women as I kept coming. So, you know, I think part of ethnographic research is also that you show up every day and eventually the novelty wears out. And, you know, you don't become an insider fully. I don't think that was the case in my research, but at least they get used to your presence and, you know, they do develop some kind of relationship with you. So the ethnographic work and interviews with key informants led me to do archival research in the City Civil and Sessions Court. I had not planned for that part to be part of my thesis. And the reason is because when I spoke to several women's organizations, they were slowly buying into the myth of the misuse of Section 498A. That's the law which, you know, mitigates against domestic violence in India. It's called cruelty against wives law, or the dowry law. Mistakenly called the dowry law. It's not really the dowry law. So I had not anticipated when I wrote my research proposal that I would do an empirical study of this nature, but I took another maybe three additional months during which I did it, and it was productive though difficult 3 months to do this. As it happens with, you know, ethnographic research, things crop up in the field, and you realize that the way in which you had set it up, you need more information in order to complete the picture. So I understood the ways in which judges trivialized and normalized domestic violence, contributing to the low conviction rate, you know, and further reinforcing the myth that women are filing fake cases of domestic violence. And then when I returned back to my university and I was writing my thesis, I realized that there were some questions which could be answered also using quantitative techniques and triangulated in that way. So I spent some time analyzing the National Family and Health Survey to examine what puts women at higher risks of domestic violence and to what extent that mirrored my ethnographic experience. If there were gaps, if there were convergences and divergences. So I haven't put this material in the book, but there is a separate paper co-authored with another colleague where we do this systematically, published in the EPW, and it focuses on the reporting of domestic violence. And the reason why I'm laying all these methods out is because I think that, you know, social science, especially the kind of research that we do these days, has become so interdisciplinary that we draw from so many disciplines in terms of the methodologies that we use. I think that there is some value in understanding how all these methods work as well.
Right. And thank you so much for putting that in words. Shripana, I had a different question because in the introduction, I said that the book is published by Crossed Arrows in 2023. So is there a different version of the book available as well?
No. This is the only version.
Okay. All right. And let me also ask you about if the book is only about stories of domestic violence, or is it also about other things like women's friendships and negotiations?
So the book is much more, I would like to believe, than stories of domestic violence or how and why violence centers are managed or a household and strategies for mitigation. There is that. But the first part of the book, which is about respect, engages substantially with women's friendships and their negotiations, both within and outside of the household. So, you know, it is about people chasing respect and respectability, wanting to be loved and desired, forging intimate relationships, facing betrayals and loss, in the face of challenging circumstances, being very inventive. And there are also parts where they are, you know, in despair and hopeless as well as expressing deep solidarity with each other one moment, and then in the next moment something happens and those networks have fallen apart. So, for example, if you remember from the book, you know, through Kamini, who is one of the women that I got to know really well, you get a nuanced understanding of how respect is crafted. And also its ephemerality, that it's very, very, you know, it's almost a delicate thing that anything can unravel it. And through her example, I think what I learned is that it's possible to subvert certain patriarchal norms because she had made this choice of living with, you know, a male relative after her husband abandoned her. But, and that this is possible, that this sort of exertion of agency is possible by women who we believe have limited agency, but this is not without consequences, right? So, and this is a real tightrope walk, and people may not always be able to do this successfully. So I think that the fact that marriage or this kind of, you know, marriage-like relationship becomes a survival strategy for most women in this context is not something, I think that there needs to be a lot more engagement with this particular idea. And that's what I have tried to do in the book as well.
Right. So let me also ask you about the conceptual tools that you have used in this book. What kinds of tools that you have used?
So in the book, I have drawn from multiple frameworks, disciplines, and conceptual toolkits. So, you know, somewhat like a cross-pollinator, whatever I found useful, what the data was pointing me towards was what I used. So in that sense, I think that maybe this is, you know, quite a departure from many of the academic sort of rooted in foundational disciplines, ethnographies that you might see. So for example, you know, I explicate the relationships between structural violence and domestic violence using frameworks which medical anthropologists like Paul Farmer and others have used to understand why diseases like HIV/AIDS and TB ravaged some communities but not others. Secondly, the political economy of violence and inequality is a very important architectural framework in my work because I really believe that domestic violence is not just an individual pathology. And you can see that in the book as well, but it's embedded in our institutions, whether that's marriage, judicial system, economic systems, or others. So, and thirdly, I have used the concept of household insecurity, which is drawn from political ecology frameworks related to food insecurity, to highlight why early marriages take place. So the reasons why girls are married early, I'm not necessarily talking about child marriages, but early marriages, and how that has adverse effects for women, outcomes for women and girls, are also the reasons why they are unable to escape abusive marriages. So, you know, this is actually helpful because it helps me problematize the notions of resilience, which are often used by, you know, people in disaster studies or in psychology, because I feel that it has become extremely depoliticized in recent years. So the drive to quickly build resilience among communities which have been ravaged by decades of institutional neglect by doing something tokenistic, I think is at best disingenuous and at worst insidious. So, of course, throughout the book, I use feminist standpoint theories and insights drawn from the work of scholars who work on gender and post-coloniality to problematize notions of agency. But I also use other perspectives and frameworks, which I think, you know, exemplifies the arguments or clarifies it in a way that readers will be able to access quite easily.
Right. And one can see that. So, you know, please also talk a little bit about how the book is arranged. What is the thought that went behind the sections and the, you know, arrangement?
Right. So the book took me quite a long time to write. So I think I finished writing it towards the end of the first wave of the pandemic in 2020. But I started writing it somewhere in 2014. Yeah, if I remember correctly, in 2014. So it was nearly 6 years in the making, and it went through a lot of overhaul in my own head, in my own writing. And finally, I decided that I could, from what I could see, there were three main, I don't want to call them themes because they are much larger than themes, but notions, which were very, very important for my respondents, which were emerging. So the book is divided into those three chunks, excluding the prologue and the epilogue and the concluding chapter. So the first part is called Kya Meri Izzat Nahi Hai, In Search of Respect in Sundar Nagar. And I haven't done a chapter format in this book. So I hope that the readers won't find this confusing. And the second one is called Love, Lesions, Longing, and Living. And the third is called Fragility, Resilience, and Resistance. So I had spoken to nearly 52 women over the course of my research, and I have included the stories of a handful, those that I grew close to, and I felt best symbolized the problems that I was trying to address. So as I said, in the first part, we're looking at women's negotiations around respect, both the corporeality of respect, the links between being a tenant versus being, an owner. So how home ownership can give respect in this community. The second part, love, lesions, longing, living, has stories of multiple women, some of whom experienced domestic violence and some who did not. And it was important for me as a writer, I think, to tell the reader that the trope that all women living in low-income communities suffer from domestic violence is untrue. There are also very loving and beautiful marriages characterized by equity. And I would say perhaps more so than one might find, in a typical upper class family in India. The third part, which is fragility, resilience, and resistance, includes narratives of men that were interviewed about the use of violence in resolving conflicts. So the fragility here not only refers to women's fragility, but also fragility of communities, male fragility, and ambivalence towards the use of violence. And in a sense, I felt that the ambivalence that men expressed is generative because it allows us to intervene and capitalize on it to make violence less acceptable. The last section of the book, which is a concluding section, is called The Ephemerality of Subversion and the Challenges of Transformation, because I wanted to highlight that unless major structural changes take place, such as opening up of more good quality women's and children's shelters, childcare arrangements go through an overhaul, transitionary employment for women fleeing abusive marriage, and ultimately working towards a gender transformative society where marriage is not the only route for securing financial or other kinds of securities for Indian girls, we will not see a substantive reduction in incidences of domestic violence.
Yeah, and this is what makes me also ask the next question, because, how can one understand respect in relation to women's bodies and what is the role of marriage in this? Because it's not that after marriage, women have a very rosy life. These instances right. of domestic violence highlight that. So how do you see it?
So I think women's bodies, and as you know, because you work on food and comportment, have always been sites of contesting moralities and surveillance by the trinity of patriarchy, state, and religion, right? So, and as I show in the book, part of the problem is also the internalized misogyny that girls and women express towards each other in making comments, shaming, and surveilling their peers. So in any, if you think about, respect in relation to women's bodies, I think they are so intertwined because even today in any country in the world, if there's an incidence of sexual assault, the first question is what was the victim wearing and where was she and why was she there when the incident occurred? So, how our bodies moving, how our bodies dressed become very important. And marriage further constrains women's bodies by making them conform to patriarchal expectations of clothing, comportment, and the submission of their bodies to their husband's desires. So some people might think that, marriage can be freeing because the prospect of marriage is no longer hanging over like a sword over women's heads. They can do whatever they want. But I don't think this works in practice, at least in resource-poor contexts. And the reason why I'm saying this is because often, in a middle class and upper middle class families, you might hear something like, oh, until you get married, you can't do this. After marriage, it's okay, you can do this. But the reality is that there might be even more constraints after marriage that are put on women, especially in relation to, their bodies.
Right. And we do see that unfolding as well. So do you think that the idea of love can be understood separately from that of violence?
This is a really difficult question and I have struggled with it in my book, in my head. And I don't think I have a satisfactory response to this, but I'll still attempt to answer it. So for many women who encounter domestic violence, there are a lot of complex and contradictory feelings towards their husbands. And often, control masquerades as love. So we have seen, it's also partly because the way in which the media shows us what love is, right? Scores of films and series where they show that the more possessive a lover is, greater is his depth of feelings. So we have come to recognize this increasingly, as you know, sociologists, as women's studies scholars, as toxic, but it takes a lot of undoing of social conditioning to understand that. And I think that, you know, violence should never be equated to love, but we should be prepared for the eventuality that those who love us can also hurt us. So in that sense, I think, love and violence are related. And I'm not just talking about physical abuse, but even emotional harms, in that if you leave yourself vulnerable, you know, to love and to be loved, you are equally vulnerable to be hurt as well.
Interesting. Well, you know, it is a difficult question, as you put it. But the next question is also about domestic violence. And if, you know, alcoholism and unemployment as factors could be connected to it, what would you think?
So over the years, there has been a lot of secondary data which uses, you know, massive data sets around the world that have confirmed that alcoholism lowers inhibition and increases the risks of domestic violence. And in my research, I found that not only is this the mechanism that, you know, lowering of inhibitions, but also because alcohol diverts resources from a household. So if a household is already under financial stress, which a lot of households are in this resource poor context, it is likely this diversion of resources will likely lead to fights. When men are inebriated, there are demands for more expensive food, and often that cannot be met by wives, and that can lead to arguments too. And lastly, I feel that the public drunkenness of a husband leads to loss of respect for the family and the woman, and that becomes a trigger for arguments as well, because even in an informal settlement, a woman who's Bambaya Hindi, they would say PK lafda kar raha hai ya PK tamasha kar raha hai, which means, you know, making a scene and creating nuisance after drinking, is seen as disrespectful for the family and the woman. It's not normalized. So I think all of this is can be connected to domestic violence and its triggers. So, and unemployment can be a huge trigger for both alcoholism and domestic violence. So in psychology, I believe that there are some scholars who believe that alcoholism is a form of maladaptive coping mechanisms. So in that, it means that the loss of status and resources that accompanies loss of jobs creates huge amounts of stress in an individual. And one way of coping with this is through the use of alcohol, any substance. It can be drugs, tobacco, whatever, because it will allow you to temporarily detach from these worries. And if the wife has to take up employment, which has happened in situations, as you know, some of the women's stories will demonstrate, it also hurts the pride of the man because he's been conditioned to believe that he's the sole breadwinner and he's failing in some way if he can't provide. So this crisis of masculinity also precipitates domestic violence.
Right. And an interlinked question, what is the importance of filial love and kinship networks in dealing with domestic violence?
So filial love, kinship, and friendship networks are critical in mitigating domestic violence and escaping from abuse. I think that's true in any context, not just in a resource-poor context. But it is particularly true in a resource-poor context because women have limited means to support themselves. So in my study, I found that women who had the support of their natal family were able to return. Or even if they couldn't permanently return, they could temporarily seek refuge until things had calmed down. And, and women's natal family is usually the first, port of call when it comes to reporting domestic violence. We know from our research that this is definitely the case, that women's, usually they'll speak to their parents or they'll speak to their brothers or sisters. But this relationship also gets very complicated. So if you look at Jigna and Leela Bain's stories from the book, even if natal families ask them to return and have the resources to support them, because both of these women came from landed families in Western India, In Jigna's case, there was a history of forced marriage. Her marriage to her husband had been forced upon her by her brothers, who beat her up, put her under house arrest to prevent her from marrying her boyfriend. And while several years had passed from this incident, she had not forgotten it. So she was very reluctant to go back, although she had every reason to. And in Leela Ben's case, another sister had already returned due to intolerable domestic violence, and she didn't want to overburden the family. So, and then there are cases like Salma's case, where there was simply no resources, and despite living in close proximity to their daughter, her family was not able to support her at all. So I think that, unfortunately, the cultural idioms that we have, like beti paraya dhan hai, a girl is a form of wealth that belongs to someone else, and the practice in many parts of India, I think majority of India, of village exogamy, you get married in a different village, sometimes, a village that's quite far away. And the mass migration of women after marriage for their husband's jobs puts them in an especially vulnerable position. Like, for example, if, your listeners have seen Lapata Ladies, you'll see that in this particular village, they have had to use so many different modes of transport, and it takes so long to go to the husband's house, right? So being able to having the safety net of the natal family that you can return anytime, it doesn't have to be around certain festivals. If things get bad, just come back. I think having that thought is extremely important. But as we have seen lately, even in places like Kerala, which have very high levels of human development indicators and greater gender parity than the rest of the country, there have been dowry deaths, there have been suicides associated with, harassment from the marital family. So even in wealthy contexts, you see that the idea that you can return to your natal family either is not there or is not supported by the natal family, which is, I think, really sad.
Right. And I think this is also something that a lot of people who work on domestic violence and kinship talk about as well. And my next question is, how do you understand marital rape in this work? And very recently, again, in the Indian context, we have had a debate on whether or not it should be legalized. So how do you look at it?
So I think part of the problem is that because it has not been legalized, we haven't fully developed a vocabulary to understand the nuances of sexual violence within marriage. So marital rape is one form of sexual violence, and perhaps it's the form that is easiest to understand and empathize with. But there are others too, as I describe in the book. So when Jigna's husband used to leave the door open while she changed her clothes, that is also a form of sexual humiliation, right? So until and unless I think that marital rape is recognized as a violation of women's human rights, and the fact that consent needs to be continually negotiated even within a marriage, I don't think that we will be able to address it adequately, right? Because currently the understanding is that if you get married, consent is automatic. But that is really a very flawed understanding of how consent works or should work in marriage. So, and this leads to a normalization of a lot of sexual violence within marriage. So, and to top it, we have judges who say in their verdicts that it is not the same to be raped by a husband versus a stranger. Somehow they believe that it is worse to be raped by a stranger than a husband, because a husband cannot rape, because by law, you are married. So where does the question of rape come in? So I think that there's a lot of work that needs to be done to change the ideas within the judicial system. And the reason why I feel that marital rape has still not been criminalized is partly also because there's this, idea that it will be misused. Just like this myth that Section 498 is being misused by a wide number of, women. In fact, the men's rights lobbies and the men's rights activist groups, the MRAs in India, have been very successful in clawing back some of the progressive aspects of Section 498A as well. And they will, and if the feminist groups don't, gather and pressurize our legislators, I think it will be a long time before we see the criminalization, despite what the Justice Verma Commission has recommended.
Right. And again, a related question. We did very fleetingly talk about it, as you mentioned. But how important is it to incorporate men's voices in a work on violence?
It's critical, but sadly, it doesn't happen as often as it should. So there are some great organizations like Men Against Violence and Abuse, MAVA in Mumbai, which has been doing anti-violence work and trying to change deeply entrenched patriarchal norms that encourage abusive behavior for 27 years plus. However, most scholarly research on DV doesn't engage with men, unless these are from psychology, where the intervention is with perpetrators of domestic violence and how to change their behavior. We don't have too many of those programs in our country. I think we should, but we don't. And the socialization of men into dominant modes of masculine behavior, and we know what these are, right? Not showing emotions, using violence to resolve conflict, normalization of wife abuse, also has grave consequences for men as much as it has for women and families. I was in equal measure shocked and terrified to see the popularity of a film like Annam. And I'm sure, I haven't watched the film, but I have read enough reviews to know the fact that such depictions of toxic masculinity became such a hugely grossing, widely popular movie is cause for us to worry. Instead of showcasing that patriarchy harms men, and although they gain from a patriarchal society, they don't have any choices, because there are men who are gender diverse, right? They may be born as men, but they could be trans, they could, and equally for women. So if we get out of the men-women binary and look at gender more holistically as well, doing this kind of work where we are trying to undo some of these toxic, deeply entrenched patriarchal norms will, improve the lives of everyone, including gender diverse people.
Right. Again, we did speak about it when you were talking about the arrangement of the book, that the last section is about fragility and resilience, and you use them together. So any particular reason behind it?
So thank you for this question, because this is another section that I had to, go back and forth with in terms of situating it within the book. I'm not going to give such an academic response to it, but this is going to come straight from, not necessarily from a space of reason, but definitely from a space of emotion. And I believe that fragility is inherent to all of us. The very act of living makes us vulnerable. Falling in love, and I don't just mean romantic love, but forming intimate relationships, friendships, relationships with our parents, siblings, with the extended family. All of this, they make us fragile when things go terribly wrong. So I think being fragile and being human cannot be separated. What I attempted to do in an academic sense in this section was politicizing resilience, because I think it has become deeply apolitical. The term is tossed around in such a way as if resiliency can be achieved overnight if the right tools became available. But the truth about it is that the communities that are living in conditions of poverty and other forms of socioeconomic exclusions and deprivations, this is not easy. So we know that, for example, inequality has been increasing in India, and that, regardless of what statistics we have access to or not, we know that the gap between the super rich and those who are living in absolutely wretched conditions of poverty has increased so much. So if there is continued stress at the individual household and community level, we know that resilience reduces greatly. So it's like, the example of an elastic band. If you keep stretching it and stretching it, eventually it will break. So I feel that unless these structural forms of injustice are acknowledged and remedied, I don't think patchwork solutions to achieve resilience will work. And that's the main reason why I sort of juxtapose them together, to make people think that, you know, fragility is not a pathological state. It is a state which is sort of the normal response to when you are met with a crisis, right?
Right. Well, you know, whatever we sort of think through and it basically know about domestic violence, a lot of it has been shattered and unshattered in this book, and I've been privileged to read it. So I would also like to recommend it to our listeners to pick up a copy of Sriparna's book. Thank you so much, Sriparna, for giving me this time and talking to me. I think it was a wonderful conversation on such a, you know, sensitive topic.
Thank you so much, Rituparna, for giving me the opportunity to speak about the book. And the book currently is out of stock, which makes me a little embarrassed. But
it that's
is
a good thing, right?
But it is available on Google Play. So should your readers want to read an e-copy, they can download it from Google Play as well.
Yeah. Thank you so much for letting our listeners know that. And, you know, hopefully the book comes back in stock soon.
Yeah, thank you so much.